Michael Graciano is Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Princeton University. His research at the Princeton Neuroscience Institute focuses on the brain basis of consciousness, how the brain produces an internal subjective experience that is non-physical and on first inspection may seem mysterious, but that nonetheless can be examined, studied and explained by science. He is the author of Consciousness and the Social Brain, published in 2013 by Oxford University Press, and the forthcoming The Spaces Between Us, A Story of Neuroscience, Evolution and Human Nature, to be published in 2018 by Oxford University Press. Consciousness is obviously a contentious term historically, both philosophically over the last few hundred years and obviously in the 20th century as well, where it's come under the umbrella study of science. There's also definitional problems in terms of what somebody means by consciousness, and obviously this has opened up the floodgates to the hard problem in terms of whether our conscious experience, even at a basic phenomenological level, can solely be explained by the brain. Others think that the hard problem is complete nonsense and it just has to do with a definitional term in terms of your inner experience must be different from the material processes going on in the brain produced by neurons, so it's a definitional problem. So from your perspective and your work, how do you feel the best way to describe consciousness is?
Right. Well, you're certainly right. The term consciousness has so many different meanings. That leads to a lot of confusion. And the mix of meanings tends to change over time. And I think there's a particular way of thinking about it, or a particular use of that term that's become more frequent in science, in neuroscience and psychology in, let's say, the past 15 or 20 years. And that's the meaning I tend to use of that word consciousness. It goes something like this, that most people, when we think about consciousness, we think about the content of the conscious mind, our memories, our perceptions of the world around us, our sense of self, our internal dialogue, the decisions we make, all the things of which we can be conscious that make up the conscious mind. So that's the content of consciousness. But increasingly in our computerized world, the content of consciousness becomes less and less mysterious. More and more it's clear how a machine can have a memory, how a machine can recall memories, how a machine can make decisions. Computers make decisions all the time. They take in data and on that basis choose what course of action to follow. But what's missing, the part that has remained a mystery, is how we get to have a subjective experience of any of those things. And so more and more when people in neuroscience and psychology use the term consciousness, they tend to mean subjective experience of anything at all, anything at all. So in other words, if we could explain how you look at a spot on a screen, just a little spot appearing on a computer screen, and how you have a visual subjective experience of that spot. You don't just report the information, there is a spot, but you say, I saw it. I have awareness of that spot. If we could explain that for just one little tiny spot, then the same explanation in principle could be transferable to the whole panoply of stuff in one's mind. So that has become kind of the nub, and indeed sometimes called the hard problem. Just that one piece, subjective experience of anything at all. So that's what I tend to mean by the word consciousness or awareness or subjective experience. All of these used a bit interchangeably.
Some people say that this problem, this subjective experience, i.e. Thomas Nagel, the famous philosopher of mind, which is what's it like to be a bat? I don't really know what it's like to be Michael. Michael doesn't really know what it's like to be Tony. We can have a rough assumption what it is for another person to be a conscious agent. That's leaving a zombie argument aside, that you could literally be a computer with no inner self-awareness, but that's a separate issue for the moment. But some people say that this subjective experience, that the red you see might not be exactly the same red I see, still isn't such a fundamental problem that it should slow down the research program of explaining mind and consciousness in whichever facets you want to define it by the material brain, as in a pure reductionist argument in terms of this subjective experience we're having right now, you might ever have when you listen to music or have a film, just literally is the same and can be broken down by your material processes going on in the brain. Do you think that's a valid argument in itself? Because I've also heard you say that it's quite, as you define it, it's quite interesting in terms of brain is responsible for self-describing itself, i.e. our consciousness is a construct that we make ourselves that comes out of the brain, i.e. kind of going down the paths of consciousness being a general illusion. So there's kind of two questions in there, but first of all, how do you feel about whether you think this subjective experience, sometimes labeled as quali, is that important? And after that, what you can say about how our brain through awareness constructs this idea of being conscious. Really, it can be reduced down to just pure awareness in the brain.
So I think it is an important question. I actually think it's a terribly important question. First of all, this is something that everyone has, or at least everyone claims to have. And whenever you see that in biology, that every member of a species has a particular trait, you start to think, well, there might be some actual adaptive value to that trait. You know, why is it there? Computation is expensive. The brain doesn't just waste computational energy. So I think there's a great deal of importance to this question, and it's a very fundamental question. But I would say this about it. I think people have been framing the question in a way that makes an answer impossible. And there is a way of seeing it that makes an answer extremely approachable scientifically. But I think the way many people have been thinking about this is something like this. So there's this awareness thing, this subjective experience stuff. When I look at something, or when I feel a touch on my hand, or when I think anything at all, I have a subjective experience of that's somehow associated with that inner information or that inner process. Almost like a heat rising up from circuitry. There's something extra that comes along. That's my inner experience. How does the brain produce that extra inner experience? And that's one way of thinking about it. I think that as soon as you start pursuing the question that way, you're sunk. There's no possible answer. You're totally on the wrong track. I would approach it differently. I would say by now, neuroscientists have a pretty good sense that the brain is a kind of machine. It's a information processing machine. It's not identical to a digital computer, but it is a kind of computer. It processes information. And everything that we claim, everything we say, every utterance or belief that comes out of us depends on that information. I mean, the brain, the mind, you could say the mind is like, it's like a sculpture. It's like a trillion stranded sculpture made out of information. And that information's constantly shifting and changing. And everything we claim to be true depends on that underlying information. And so if I make the claim that I have subjective experience, if I go around saying, oh, there's something in me that has a qualia, phenomenology, whatever you want to call it, awareness, a subjective awareness of things. If I can say that, it is logically because something in my brain computed the requisite information that allows me to make that assertion. So what we're talking about is information that is constructed in the brain that we can output to the outside world. And that information is somehow descriptive of what's going on inside us, right? So we're talking about self models. The claim that I have subjective awareness, that comes about because there's an incredibly giant information processing machine that's building self models, that's describing itself. And self models are really important. And this is something I learned in years and years of studying how movement is controlled. And it's something roboticists and engineers understand. If you want an intelligent control system, it needs models of itself. And so that's why I think this is such a terribly important engineering problem. It's not just a philosophical problem. If we want to understand how the brain works and how the brain has a good intelligent control over itself, we need to understand its self models. And I think that's what this whole thing is. The deep question that we're trying to answer is, not how a brain becomes aware, but really we're trying to understand how a machine arrives at a specific, really quirky claim and how it attaches such a high degree of certainty to that claim. And that's all very scientifically approachable. It's a question of mechanistic process.
So just to summarize some points, and obviously correct them if I've misunderstood anything, but essentially the real phenomenological experience is that we self-model through our awareness, and because of that, we then potentially depict that we have this quasi-magical special subjective experience, when really it's just this awareness produced by our own brain that allows us to model this internal experience.
I think that maybe not how I would have put it, but I think that's in the direction that I'm saying, yes. So I'll give you an example. Since so many people, when I talk to them about consciousness, they say, well, that's such a mystery. Will we ever solve the mystery? I don't like that point of view. I always say, no, it's not a mystery. Well, of course, we don't know the answer, but it's not a fundamental mystery. Consciousness is about as mysterious as the mysterious energy that comes out of your eyes and pushes on things when you look at them. Okay? That's not really a mystery in this sense. There is no mysterious energy that comes out of your eyes and pushes on things. It's not there, but there's a very interesting scientific and psychological explanation as to why people tend to believe that. So the point is that there's a lot of information constructed in the brain. Not all of it's literally accurate. And it gets very hard when you take all of it to be literally accurate, like our tendency to think of vision as something that streams out of the eyes. It's extremely hard to explain something streaming out of the eyes in terms of physical reality. It's not there. But you can explain why a machine arrived at that type of a description of the world.
So I wasn't concise enough the first point. You're essentially saying that we have awareness that's produced by our brain, and therefore, because not all the information produced by the brain is accurate ontologically, that then can produce this kind of residual problem of why is it that's so special that I have this subjective experience?
In effect, subjective experience is like the stuff coming out of your eyes.
Yes.
It's not really there. It's the brain's shortcut way of describing what it's doing. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm trying to say. But you're also saying that essentially the real phenomenological issue going on here is some form of awareness produced by the brain, which then might have residual problems that are added on later, such as my subjective experience in inverted commas. But essentially, as you're saying, it's the brain modeling itself to a certain extent.
That's right. So I would make a distinction here that many people make between what's sometimes called, and I hope this doesn't get too wonky here. Some people make a distinction between objective awareness and subjective awareness. And that can get very confusing in a conversation about it. And so objective awareness means information gets in and the brain processes it. And we have objective awareness. So does a computer. So does your microwave. If you punch in numbers, your microwave is objectively aware of the time that you put in, right? So there's objective awareness. But then there's this other concept of subjective awareness, that you have an intangible, non-physical inner experience. And basically what I'm suggesting here is that the subjective awareness, something the brain tells itself it has, because that's an easy way for the brain to understand itself and model itself. Objective awareness, of course, is something the brain does have. It's a big processing device.
What you're saying would also be essentially umbrellaed under the aspect that this first person subjective experience that we have isn't really what we think it is. It's essentially an illusion produced by the brain to make you think that it's something else than it really is. Just like this magical stuff coming out of your eyes for vision isn't exactly what you might think it is. It's just, again, another format of brain processing.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, and that also explains to you, because I know obviously you're not a philosopher of mind, but this also addresses the aspect of the hard problem in philosophy of mind. So certain people that aren't reductionist or materialist or physicalist in any experience when it comes to the mind and qualia would say that if you're saying that why is it that we have this magical experience, if you frame the question in that way, it's impossible to answer. So you're changing what it is to have this subjective experience, which essentially is an illusion, and you can answer that by science. Now, philosophers of mind would say, well, you're still not answering the mystery, but people such as yourself, and there's many in the scientific and the philosophical community that say that it's not that we're not answering the question, it's just that the question itself is wrong in terms of definition, because you're still treating this quality of this magical subjective experience, and how does it explain that, as where people such as yourself are saying, well, once you change your definitions around and basically assert that qualia is explained one way or another by the brain, then these residual problems, quote unquote, that aren't really problems, dissolve.
Yes. I would add, though, that one thing that's slightly different about our approach is we're not so much trying to sweep away the hard problem as explain why people have such a strong tendency to believe that there is a hard problem.
Yes, exactly. That what problem? Yes.
And that's very important. That's one of the main points of what we're saying here, is that there's this incredibly useful adaptive value to having those kinds of shortcut, quick and dirty self-descriptions. So to go back to the stuff streaming out of the eyes, you know, why on earth does the brain produce that weird kind of, well, why are we so prone to that? Well, it's a really quick and easy, convenient way to keep track of who's looking at what, right? If you want to design your system in a way that it doesn't have to know anything about the real physical properties of light or vision, but you want to give it a quick and dirty construct so that it can keep track of who's looking at what. That's a really beautiful, easy trick. So evolution builds that into us. We have this very strong tendency to perceive vision as something that streams out of the eyes and touches things. So it's very, very useful. And there's a reason why people believe that. And so that's kind of what we're trying to approach, is not to solve the hard problem, but to explain why people think there is a hard problem to begin with.
Yeah, exactly. As the church, instead of both notorious philosophers of mine, is in the hard problem, what problem? This hard problem itself has become asset of folk psychology. There is no hard problem. People think there is because they think it's somehow mysterious. People like yourself and the Churchians would say there isn't a problem. You've made the problem up from the framework you're approaching it from. And there's many that would agree that. Obviously, Daniel Dennett's got the fame in the brain, which is something similar, obviously not completely the same, but something similar to your line of work. One thing I do also want to ask at this point is, I'm sure it's tiresome and you've been asked this many times before, but essentially, as a neuroscientist, and I don't know to what extent you've been trained in philosophy of science, but philosophy of science 101 principles, obviously correlation is not causation, and some people say that all neuroscience can produce is correlations, therefore the brain in that sense deductively cannot explain consciousness. What would you say to those people, and what else have you got to say from your work or from the work of your colleagues that can show that, well, neuroscience can do more than just produce correlations, or at least give us more to work with than just mere correlations?
Right. Well, one of the most important aspects of the work that we're doing, the perspective that we're taking, is to try to get at the actual usefulness of this awareness stuff. If we self-model, if this is the brain's easy, quick and dirty way of describing itself, what good does that do you? And what we've done is taken this whole area of research that comes from engineering, basically. It comes from originally how you move a robot arm. How do you control the robot arm? Well, you need a good kind of cartoonish internal model of the arm. And so how does the brain control itself? It needs a good cartoonish internal model of itself. And what that does is open up a whole world of experiment and a whole world where it's no longer correlational. Now we're into causal effects. So what happens when you have little gaps in your awareness? What happens, most of the visual stimuli that stream into your eyes, you're not aware of. Your brain processes it. It has an impact on your behavior that's measurable, but you're not subjectively aware of it. So what are the consequences of that? If that stuff is not being incorporated into these simplified internal models, and there you can get into a whole set of predictions about how the brain can react to things it's not aware of, but it lacks certain kinds of control. It lacks certain kinds of adaptability. And so there's really specific predictions you can make about the consequences of awareness or consciousness being this simplified internal model. We get into some really interesting territory. I think what we do, we get away from this concept that's been around for a long time, that consciousness is kind of an epiphenomenon. It doesn't do anything. It's some floaty thing. And then you can argue forever. Do we have it? Do we not? What is it? I don't know. But as soon as you get into the kind of theory where consciousness actually is a cog in the machine, it's a really important part of the machine. The self model is a really important part of the machine. And when it fails, as it does now and then, you have these really specific errors that the machine makes, and then you can put these kinds of predictions to a test.
And that's how you start to move away from just mere correlations to, for example, if there's certain gaps in certain processes, then you can start entering the territory of causal explanation. You've slightly touched on it already just with your last response there, but what does the subconscious in all this lend credence to your overall body of work in terms of this idea that we have in a subjective experience is basically something that's produced by the brain, which isn't completely accurate, it's something else. What does the role of the subconscious do that also lends credence to this overarching theory?
Right. Well, certainly most of what goes on in the brain we're not conscious of. We don't report. We have no idea. I wouldn't know what the proportion is, but it's got to be pretty high, 99% at least of this going on up there. And of course, this makes it very hard to think about. For example, if you talk to people about decision making, there's a kind of intuitive notion that decisions are conscious events. I consciously decide this or that, because the only decisions we have direct experience with are decisions that we are also conscious of. That's sort of tautological. But the truth is the brain's making tens of thousands of decisions a day without your conscious participation. Most of what's going on in there, whether it's perception in the sense of processing input, or whether it's decision making, or whatever it is going on in there, it's mostly unconscious. A small amount of it gets this weird consciousness thing attached to it. In our perspective or our approach, it gets incorporated into this particular kind of self model. And then our cognition and our language has access to it, and we can talk about it and so on. The unconscious mind is gigantic. It plays an absolutely gigantic role. The interesting part is to ask the questions, what do you gain when you do have reportable consciousness of something? What does that give you? What are the benefits of it? And I think that's where much of my research right now is focused, and really looking at situations that are as equivalent as we can get them, like a picture on a screen, where in one case you just don't see it, in another you do, but it has an impact on you in both cases. So what's the difference? What do you gain by being conscious of it that you lose when you're not conscious of it? And what we see is, like I alluded to before, what we see is that consciousness gives you certain kinds of abilities to control the internal system. And this plays right into this notion of the consciousness acting as this self-description, this internal model that's used to help control the system. So the unconscious stuff is really important in that whole equation. It's part of that whole sweep of experimental work that you look at unconscious processing, conscious processing, that kind of gray transition between them, and you start asking, what are the specific mechanistic benefits of the stuff getting into consciousness?
Free will is kind of a loaded term as well, just like consciousness. But a lot of that work that you're currently doing would also go, as you're saying, obviously most people believe that a decision is something that is made consciously through reasoning and logic and reflection that we're consciously aware of. But a lot of research has shown that a lot of it is actually subconscious operations going on before you're consciously aware of it. A lot of your decisions are actually reached to a certain extent before you're consciously aware of them. And obviously that ties into issues of whether people actually do have free will. And obviously there's been loads of work done, well, not loads, but recent work done in the area of moral philosophy in terms of the implications for this for the criminal justice system. But can I just ask, what else are some of the goals of your current research in this area? Because it sounds very interesting.
Well, the ultimate goals are to really understand how this machine makes this extraordinary claim that it has magic inside of it, essentially. And what role that plays in the machine controlling itself. We want to understand that. We want to understand what the networks in the brain are that are involved in that. But also, one of the ultimate goals is to try to understand this stuff well enough to be able to engineer it. And that's always kind of a sci-fi sounding thing. But that is one of the goals, is to try to understand this consciousness stuff well enough to be able to engineer it so that we can have intelligent computer systems that are socially competent, that know what consciousness is, that can know that you are conscious, that can interact with you in a way that's more humanly skilled.
Sounds interesting, and I, well put, and I understand what you mean there. Before I let you go, just a few questions. First of all, it's pointless asking you whether you believe in zombies, because I don't think you do, and by your work it sounds impossible to do. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think you do, so that one's done, that's it. Also, I assume you know who Christopher Koch is, and a leading, or Koch, German surname, another leading neuroscientist, I believe was at Caltech.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was speaking to Donald Hoffman at UC Irvine about this, and I'm always slightly confused about Koch's approach, because apparently lately he's turned around and said that mind can't solely be explained by a computational brain. What are your thoughts on that, and what would you say are some of the problems potentially in Koch's work?
I think, so first of all, Christoph Koch has made lots and lots of contributions to thinking about this area of neuroscience, how the brain relates to consciousness. I think he has gone in a direction that is, in my view, going off the scientific path. I think that there's an underlying assumption there. So he and other people such as Tononi, who's a kind of part of this integrated information approach, they take an approach that is kind of a sci-fi trope, that if you build it big enough and complicated enough, it'll become conscious. That consciousness is an emergent property, that it's an add-on. It isn't information itself. It's a thing that emerges when you get enough complexity or integration of information. And to me, that's fundamentally non-scientific. I mean, it's basically accepting that there is kind of floaty thing that's non-physical, that's produced by the brain, and we don't know how. I find that problematical. I find it problematical for a lot of reasons. One reason is the theory doesn't actually explain how we can go around saying we're conscious. Because once you get the floaty thing emerging from your brain, how does that consciousness, non-physical consciousness stuff, then affect your speech mechanism that allows you to say that you're conscious? So to me, that whole approach is a little bit derailed. It's kind of gone outside the realm of science into mysticism, and I think they are misled. I think that the question in front of us is not how the brain produces the non-physical essence. The question is, how does the machine make the claim that it has magic?
Basically, the difference with the answer to my question, which is they've still got this idea that consciousness itself is some sort of emergent process. I suppose from the philosophical perspective, it's to do with just simply how you're defining these terms. So you would say that, why are they saying that consciousness has to be this add-on, this emergent process? They would probably, I'm not speaking for them, but these neuroscientists in general, but lots of philosophers might would say, well, why are you saying that consciousness isn't this add-on? So you're basically making another definition or assumption in the other way. But you have already answered why you feel that consciousness, from the perspective of neuroscience, does not need to be this magical emergent process that literally is the brain process. You've already answered that for me. I was just making a point there of what someone might say for the reverse argument, but you've already answered that.
Right.
Do you know Donald Hoffman at all?
I don't know him personally, no.
But are you familiar with his work?
A little bit, but tell me what you're thinking.
Okay. He's got a book coming out next year called The Case Against Reality. I was involved in aspects of the editorial review for it for him. And his Rosa Chow at Stanford would say, more or less, I can't speak for both of you, and I'm not obviously a neuroscientist, but she's basically said with similar stuff that you've said, that this hard problem gets in the way of science, that it's a philosophical problem. If you want to do scientific work on the brain, we must study how we process consciousness and consciousness. So she's said very similar stuff to you. Donald Hoffman, it's an interesting idea, but and you're really not going to, I don't think, like this, but he's basically trying to reverse the whole thing, almost going down a panpsychist approach by asserting that essentially, because through stuff like vision, that we don't see the world objectively, directly as it is sometimes, that, and because space-time, to a certain extent, has been proven, even though that's a contentious issue, by quantum mechanics and theoretical physics to be somewhat of illusion itself. There's many people that think that Einstein's paradigm of space-time is going out the window. He's reversed the whole thing in terms of consciousness is something that's fundamental and irreducible, and out of that comes the experience of space-time and what we experience of the objective world. So it's a mishmash of Cartesian dualism with a bit of Kantian philosophy, and it's quite interesting. I got back to him with some reviews. There's a lot of metaphysical problems in there, but I was just putting it up there on your radar to see if you were familiar with any of his work. You're probably not a fan, but this kind of panpsychist stuff is on the rise.
I mean, there are some aspects of that sound correct. We know that the physical world as it is out there has almost, well, is very different from the physical world reconstructed by our brains. We live in a world that our brains simulate. But for me, that's a reason to be very suspicious of anything you get through introspection.
Clearly, you can understand how he calls it the interface theory of perception. So how our conscious observation of the world is a shorthand for some form of objective reality. He uses the analogy to an icon on your desktop. So the folder on your desktop isn't actually your folder in the real material world. It's obviously a digital device, but it's a shorthand for that. That's something similar to what you're saying. But then he starts running into problems, as you're saying. So if that's the case, then logically, why should you trust any introspection at all? And there's problems of idealism in terms of the aspect of that all observed phenomena that you experience in the world is some kind of a mental construct. First, he has those types of problems. And also, he still pins it against some kind of external objective ontology, which goes back to the Kantian question in terms of how can you ever know that there is an objective world if on one hand you posit that there is and then you posit on the other hand that there's going to be evidence interpretations of it. So on the one hand, yes, it's very interesting and you can pin some arguments on it. To a certain extent, if you're a scientific realist about it, you start encountering problems in terms of if reality is something that exists independently of the observer, then that causes problems for one's own experience of consciousness, because when you're not conscious, that would mean consciousness doesn't exist. But that's obviously addressed by people in your field that think, well, consciousness isn't actually how you're defining it to be, it's an illusion produced by the brain. But as you say, Hoffman's obviously work speaks for itself, so there are elements of that are reasonable. There's some elements from my perspective that when extrapolated out logically do run into philosophical problems. But having said that, it is a phenomenal piece of work and very interesting. So I just, as obviously as a neuroscientist yourself, I wanted to get your perspectives of it. I'm sure if you were to take time and see some of his previous work, you'd get more out of it. Now, Michael, essentially, from what I've gathered in your work, you really do believe, and a few people, well, more than a few people would agree with you, and I'm sure there's many people that are already starting to work on these projects for the future, but experiences are modelled by a brain, i.e. they are produced by a brain. That means, in theory, at least in scientific theory and in principle, we can replicate, copy and upload these experiences we have as animals into a computer. Now, first of all, you've already touched upon your work, why that's possible, and clarify that more simply. And what would this mean for human society, the study of consciousness itself, and also a time frame? I'm not going to hold you over a barrel and go, give me a specific time, but first of all, explain why you really think we can take Tony and Michael and upload it onto a computer and possibly live potentially forever, or at least last a lot longer than we do now. What the technology says about this in the future and how people perhaps are already working on it in AI. So go ahead, Michael.
If the mind is information, and I think it is, that's something that's transferable. It's uploadable. It can be migrated from one machine to another machine. We just didn't evolve with USB ports in our heads. So, you know, that's something that will have to be figured out. Time frame for being able to engineer systems sophisticated enough to actually extract or measure information in someone's brain and then upload it and actually run that kind of software. You know, it's because things move so rapidly, so explosively rapidly right now, it makes it very hard to predict. But the predictions I usually give are 1 to 2 centuries. You know, it may be much quicker than that. I don't know. Things are moving at an outrageously rapid pace, information technology in general. But it's, in my view, 100% possible. There's absolutely nothing standing in the way of being able to scan the structure of a brain in sufficient detail to take the information and put it on, migrate it to another machine. The very concept that a mind is information that's migratable from machine to machine is something that we're going to end up getting used to at some point in our future. And that radically alters everything. It alters our culture, our concept of what it means to be a person, even our concept of what it means to be an individual, because suddenly you can have multiple copies and they're all doing slightly different things and slowly diverging from each other. It means the notion of the value of a living biological being changes. If you preserve its mind, maybe you care less about its body. It means that the very foundation of our of human civilization is writing. Writing is a way that we preserve knowledge across generations. But what happens if, instead of preserving knowledge by writing it down, what happens if you preserve the minds themselves, the wisdom and knowledge of these people? Then the whole, everything changes. I mean, this is a paradigm shift that I think is coming. I think will be transformative in ways that may be absolutely terrible or absolutely marvelous. I have no idea, but I'm sure that that's on our horizon.
Instead of just preserving great works via writing, we just actually preserve their minds for the future. Then obviously we just also, if they haven't written anything down, we also want to hope that they can still remember their wisdom from many centuries back.
That's true.
Which is another computational issue. Not to mention obviously a whole explosion, as you're alluding to there, in aspects of moral philosophy in terms of what's the difference between biological brain produced by a human animal and one synthetically produced by a computer. What's the rights of both? Are they equal? Are they not? It's a very interesting area. Also, the only thing possibly that can stop this, which I'm sure someone as yourself is aware of, is something that Nick Bostrom always points out, is a natural catastrophe, as in an apocalypse that could wipe out 90% of the human population. Apart from that, I would agree with you, and most people would also agree with you, that the idea that as AI improves and we can see various projects where we can at least, if not fully replicate consciousness, we can really build some form of advanced intelligence on computers, that this is probably just a matter of time.
Well, the advanced intelligence, that's here. I mean, you already got that, and that's getting more and more advanced. I think we're going to end up with computer systems that know what consciousness is, attribute it to themselves, and therefore insist they have it, and attribute it to the people they're interacting with. And when that happens, we will have machines that act just like we do. And I think at that point, maybe people will begin to realize that's what we are. We're machines that know what consciousness is, attribute it to ourselves and attribute it to others, and thereby gain a great deal of social competence. So that's coming too. That's coming relatively soon, I think within the 50 years. But the business of actually copying a biological brain and preserving the mind, migrating that mind to another machine, that I think will take a little bit longer, because we have to figure out how to actually get the information in from a brain, copy it. So that's a harder problem, but that's going to, I think it's all inevitable. You're right. Barring some giant catastrophe, like the Earth gets hit by another planet or something.
Yeah, that's the only thing that can stop it. I don't think we're that far away. 50 years, maybe a little bit longer, 70. Obviously, don't hold me to account on this, but I really don't think we're that far away from having a robot in front of you that can interact with you the same way a human would.
Yeah.
Copying the brain is obviously, it's got practical functions to it. Obviously, you've got to get all the codes right. But modding some kind of artificial intelligence that would be completely understandable vis-a-vis a human in terms of conversation, everything being self-aware, isn't probably that far away. I also don't think that it's necessary that we need that to kind of understand, or at least highly suspect, that we are computers ourselves, because many people, I'm sure, can probably appreciate that and just everyday common parlance. So, for example, no one's ever really observed a conscious being outside the brain. And I agree with a lot of philosophers of mine that say that this idea of our conscious experience, whichever way you define, is somehow separate from the brain, is an old problem from centuries back that's basically outdated and redundant. I mean, I know it sounds rather simplistic and trivial, but no one's ever actually seen a conscious intelligence outside a material brain.
That's right. One of the trends I see in history of science is that there are ideas that are very hard for the general public to swallow until it becomes of practical everyday significance. And then suddenly everyone gets it, you know, like the round Earth. Basically, nobody bothered to believe in this silly theory of a round Earth until suddenly trade routes emerged and it was really practically significant. Boom, everyone believes in it. Another interesting example I find is evolution. Much of the public does not believe in the evolution of large-scale species because it's of no practical significance to most people. But if you ask them about the evolution of germs, do viruses evolve and mutate? Suddenly everyone gets that. because it's of practical significance. And I think at the point that we start having these artificial intelligences that are integrated into our lives, that are talking as though they're conscious, that claim that they're conscious, suddenly all of these more mechanistic theories of consciousness become of great practical significance. And a lot of these kind of dualist philosophical notions, I think they're just going to evaporate. I think they're here now because it makes no difference to most people.
I'd actually go a bit further than that. I think some of these stuff that stay behind from history are because, as you're saying, once someone's faced with it practically, they've got no choice but to give it up for the two examples you just listed. But also, some people have attached to the idea that they must have a soul separate from the brain. I'm assuming largely because of a fear of death. But I bet you, for a practical reason, if you tell them, well, you definitely are a computer and we can probably make you live a lot longer if we put your brain on a computer, I bet you then people start unsurprisingly believing.
Yes.
You've got a book coming out in 2018, The Spaces Between Us, The Story of Neuroscience, Evolution, and Human Nature.
Yes, that's right. That's a book. It's about how people process the space around us, personal space, and the incredible importance of that to almost everything we do. So our social interactions depend on this unconscious concept of bubbles of space around us and around other people. The way we move through the world, the way we reach and grab and pick things up depends on this processing of space around us. Everything, almost every aspect of our lives depends on how the brain constructs a kind of 3D world immediately around the body and keeps track of objects within that world. And it turns out when you start studying that, it's like pulling on a thread that connects to everything. And so that's what that book is about.
What part of 2018 is it scheduled at this point to come out? Early, middle, or late?
Early, I think it's January.
But you also have a book from 2013, which is also on the study of consciousness.
So in 2013, I published a book, Consciousness and the Social Brain, that outlines this perspective, this very mechanistic perspective on the brain, the mind, consciousness, but really emphasizing that one of the main functions, the uses to which we put consciousness, is social interaction, social competence. The fact that I know you're conscious has a huge impact on how I interact with you. And so consciousness itself as a construct becomes foundational to us as a social species. That's what that book is about.
What is the relationship between consciousness and social awareness? Is it the move in tandem and simultaneously? You can't be consciously aware of your own consciousness without positing it on other people. Like, most people don't really believe that other people are zombies. So if you quickly can, what's the relationship between consciousness and the consciousness of other people socially?
Right. You know, I really first came to this set of ideas through ventriloquism, of all the weird directions. And I learned ventriloquism when my son was very young. He was growing up and I made his stuffed animals talk. And I was really terrible for a long time, but he made me practice every day because he really wanted his stuffed animals to talk. And I got better and better at ventriloquism. And I began to realize there's this really weird illusion people get. And it's a social illusion that there's an object that you know has no mind or brain, but you can't help this perception of a consciousness in it, a kind of conscious awareness emanating out of it. And that was kind of the start years ago of this whole line of research and line of thinking, that one of the main functions of consciousness is that we attribute it to other people, not just people, but puppets and the spaces around us. And, you know, you get mad at your coffee machine when it doesn't work right. So the world is populated with perceived consciousness that we construct in our brains and then project on the world around us. So creating models or simulations of minds and attaching them to things is intrinsically human. It's one of our defining characteristics. And we're doing this not just for other people, but also for ourselves. We're attributing these kinds of conscious mind states to ourselves as well. And it seems to be all the same circuitry in the brain that's doing. And that's one of the more interesting points from the neuroscientific end.
Andy Thompson, I think he's a psychologist, but he's got the theory of how we basically posit some kind of conscious agent onto inanimate objects. And your example of the coffee machine is quite succinct there, because I'm sure everyone can appreciate getting somewhat angry at the TV as if the TV is personally responsible for not working for you. But no, that's very interesting. Andy Thompson's got the idea that we he's a big atheist, so we posit the idea of consciousness onto the external world as the idea of God, when really it's just nature doing what it's got to do. One more question before I let you go. You've talked about what your current aims are in terms of your current research project. What do you hope to do somewhere down the line? I know you can't speak in necessarily the years ahead, but after you've got this research project, what else would you like to explore and address from the perspective of neuroscience in terms of consciousness?
I think probably I have my work cut out for me in trying to explore the particular theory, the particular structure that we have in place for trying to understand consciousness, trying to understand how the brain implements this kind of information processing, and trying to understand it at a detailed enough level that we can actually begin to engineer this stuff. So those are the goals. I think those goals are probably going to take me the rest of my life. So those are pretty ambitious goals. After that, I don't know.